Thank you. I am still Chuck C., and I'm still an alcoholic. Hi. You know, this gathering this morning really pleases me more than the one last night. Because last night was a sort of an event. You had a banquet and all that stuff, you know. But this morning, all you got was a little ham and eggs and me. So I want to thank you for coming. You know, one of the most wonderful things that I can say to you, so far as I'm concerned, is that you don't have to change anything for me to love you. If you're drunk, you don't have to get sober. If you're a thief, you don't have to quit thieving. If you're a liar, you don't have to quit lying. I love you, just the way you are. Because, you see, I know who you are, whether you do or not. And for that reason, I would love you. Now, that is a new experience for me. Because, as I believe I said last night, I spent 30 years trying to make the world over so it would be a fit place for me to live in. I didn't think much of the human race at that time. I thought you were too mean and too stupid to merit my attention. But that's all changed, thank God. I said last night I might say a few things this morning about what you told me the first night I got here. And the little song, One Day at a Time, which was done so beautifully both last night and this morning, reminds me that the first thing you told me, my first day meeting, was it was the first drink that was killing me. That one drink were too many and 1,000 weren't enough. Now, being a periodic, that had never occurred to me, and nobody had ever said it to me in my life. But when you said it was the first drink that I must not take, I played with it a while and bought it, and I've still got it. The first drink that we mustn't take. The second thing that you told me was, today is the day we don't drink. Today is the day we don't drink. Now you said, if a day's too long, how about an hour? Can you live an hour without drinking? Make that the length of your life. And don't drink for an hour and then do it again. But under no conditions, you told me, do you ever expand this time more than 24 hours? That's as long as you'll ever live in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I played with that a while and bought it, and I still have it. And it's the second greatest living lesson that I've ever learned in my entire lifetime. This is my day. I have no past. I want no future. You know, the past is nothing in the world but guilt. And the future is nothing in the world but fear. And if you want to get rid of both the guilt and the fear, living today will do it. This is my day. I have no past. I want no future. Now, when I first got here, I thought for quite a little while that we of Alcoholics Anonymous had invented the one day at a time deal, you know. I thought that was ours. But after I began getting the fog out of my mind and listening to you people pray the Lord's Prayer after the meetings, it occurred to me that somebody a couple of thousand years ago knew about the one day at a time. because he had said, "Give us this day our daily bread." And he didn't say a word about two crusts to wake up on tomorrow morning. So I figured he knew something about that. This, the second greatest living lesson that I've ever learned. This is my day. I want no past. I have no past. I want no future. And the third thing that you told me was stay close to us. You said to me, there is more wisdom in this room about your problem and its answer than in any other room on the face of the earth. Except another room just like this, where AA members are meeting. So stay close to us. Get into as many meetings as you can. And I bought that one, and I still got it. I have attended nearer five than four meetings a week for 32 years. And I've never attended one too many. And you might say to me, how do you know? My yardstick's very simple. I never had it so good. I never had it so good. This is the only easy life I have ever known. The only good life that has ever been mine in my entire lifetime. And I'm not about to change a winning formula. The gentleman that came in about the time I did said to me about 5 years ago, he says, Chuck, he says, I've quit working with what drunks. He says, I've done my part. I worked with him a long time. And it's time now to step down and let the young people do it. And he says, besides, I'm tired of getting puked on. He says, how about you? Well, I said, I sort of like to work with wet drunks. They remind me so much of me. And besides that, I'd a hell of a lot rather be the puke E than the puke R. Because I can well remember when I was both. The next thing you told me was why I can't drink like other people. Now, this is the only intellectual knowledge I think that you and I need that we didn't have when we got here. Because this is not a program of great intellect, neither is it a program of great ability. This is a program of attitude and effort. Attitude and effort. But it is good to know why we can't drink like other people. Now, this is the thing that used to beat me to death. People were saying to me for 10 years, Chuck, you can't drink, you gotta quit. And in 99 cases out of 100, it was obvious to me that they were my inferiors. And I'd look at the pipsqueak, and I'd say, why can't I drink? He does. And my answer to me was, you can and you gotta prove it. And I was still trying to prove I could drink 10 years after I lost. And nobody ever told me why I couldn't drink like other people until I came to my first meeting. Now, I went to people that should have known. I went to good medical men. Priests, preachers, and psychiatrists. People, actually, that knew more psychiatry than there is. And every one of them talked to me about willpower, backbone, and standing up and being a man. Every one of them. You see, in those days, they didn't know what was wrong with me, and they couldn't help me. And I didn't know what was wrong with me, and I couldn't help myself. So I had to die to self and come to you before I learned why I couldn't drink like other people. And you told me the first night. She said the reason I couldn't drink like other people is because I was an alcoholic. And they said to me, an alcoholic is a person who suffers with the disease of alcoholism. I had never heard that phrase in my life. I'd never heard it. Nobody had ever mentioned to me that alcoholism was a disease. As a matter of fact, I don't think anybody ever called me an alcoholic. They called me some juicy names. I used some very descriptive adjectives. But I was never alcoholic. But I've remained with you to find that medical opinion, informed medical opinion, classifies alcoholism as the second greatest killer in the country today. They used to say amongst the first four. Now they say second as a killer. And as soon as they get honest enough to put the cause of death on a death certificate, they'll find that it's number one and has been for years as a killer. It's second only to one of our social diseases, the cause for permanent insanity. And medically speaking, it is incurable. And that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. It's a very serious matter. It's a matter of life or death. And it's my life. And they explained the disease of alcoholism to me. They said it's a disease of a twofold nature. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. The allergy of the body meaning simply this, that for some reason unknown to anybody, my body cannot successfully handle alcohol. I can't oxidize it, burn it up, and get rid of it. I take one slug of liquor, I retain it. It goes into the bloodstream into the brain. And it triggers a physical demand that makes me keep on drinking until my cycle is run. Now, this is not true with 90% of those who drink. And this is one of our biggest problems. It's one of our biggest problems because we look around us and we see people successfully drinking. And we can't understand it at all. So it's an awful good thing to know that the reason we can't drink like they do is because we are different than they are, both physically and mentally. My good wife, whom some of you have heard talk, she's an Allah nani nani. She couldn't be an alcoholic if she spent the rest of her life trying. It's impossible for her to become an alcoholic. Because when she takes one drink, she gets drowsy. When she takes two, she'll go to sleep at the dinner table. Now, I don't have that action on me. When I take two, I don't go to the dinner table. So it's good to know that we're different than the normal drinker, both physically and mentally. Now, there's nothing we can do about the physical side of the disease, nothing. We accept it. And that's all we can do with it. We accept the fact that we can't successfully drink liquor. And that nothing will be able to make us successful at drinking liquor. There's no medical help for that particular side of the problem. And you can't get spiritual enough to drink liquor willfully and not get drunk. This was one of my great problems. For the last 10 years that I drank, I was convinced that God wasn't going to let anything bad happen to me. Not because I needed him, but because he needed me. I was quarterbacking on his first team. But he fooled me. I woke up one morning and the rug was gone and the floor was gone and the ground was gone. And I was at the bottom of the snake pit. So, we don't get spiritual enough to successfully drink. I've had a great deal of... Well, it's sort of funny to me, but it shouldn't be. It's a heartache, really. Because people hear me talk and they think that I'm interested in some sort of religion. And they try to find out what it is. I get calls from all over the country. I got one from Tennessee a few years ago. Fortunately, I wasn't home. And Mrs. C talked to the guy. And he says, the question I want to ask him is how come I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and was sober for 5 years and got drunk in his church? Now, that's quite an indictment. But strangely enough, many of the fellowship and many of those outside of the fellowship think that we can go further, you know, than this program of ours. I thank God that I went much further before I got here. I have no intent and no desire to go further than our fellowship. I was confronted with this not too long ago, and I said to the gentleman who happened to be one of the more successful preachers of the world, and he says to me, but some of your people want to go further. And I said, Doctor, is there any way to go further than that you dedicate your life to the service of your fellow man? He says, that's the ultimate ult. I said, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's it. So, I think it's all here, whether it is or not. That's just a little sideline on the physical allergy. Incidentally, while I'm on that subject, why do we think a Sunday morning meeting is a spiritual meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous? If it's an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, it's spiritual if it's midnight on Friday. There isn't anything else but a spiritual Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So, I get a kick out of us thinking that the Sunday morning meeting is a spiritual meeting. The allergy of the body, we can do nothing about, and nobody else can. We know that we're stuck with it forever. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And we turn to the other side of the program. The obsessions of the mind. Our program is designed to rid us of the obsessions of the mind. That's what it's for. And it will do it if we do it. And it won't do it if we don't. The only way anybody will ever know that Alcoholics Anonymous works is to work it. It's the only way anybody will ever know. Nobody in this room ever saw me drunk. You don't know whether I'm a drunk or not. Maybe I just joined this leper colony for the social prestige. So you can't take my word for it. I might be lying to you. So we gotta do it. Now that was the third thing you told me, or fourth, whatever it was. And the next thing you told me was that it was a do-it-yourself deal. It's up to me. It's up to me. If I do these things, something happens to me. If I don't do it, nothing happens. It says there just before the 12 steps. It says, here are the steps we took. TOOK, took. Which are suggested as program of recovery. It doesn't say here the steps we heard read last night. Or here the steps we learned by heart. Or here the steps we interpreted. Now if you want to stay drunk for a while, start interpreting the steps. You can interpret and nip and nip and interpret and interpret and nip. And then you nip and don't interpret. Here are the steps we took. T-O-O-K, took. If you want this thing, took them. That's all you got to do, took the steps. Something will happen. And it don't say here are the steps we conned God into taking for us. It don't say that. You know, we have some peculiar ideas in our society about what God does for us and don't do, you know. We have some very peculiar ideas about this. I got friends that think that he changes the red lights to green when they're driving down the highway. Many, many of my friends know that he supplies parking spaces for them. I get problems up on my hill. I live on a hill. I get people coming up there with clandestine problems. And they say to me, this has to be God's will because our higher power got us together. And I say, is that so? You know, I don't hardly feel that there's a God any place on earth that has nothing else to do but get me a bedfellow. I don't understand that kind of thinking. Isn't that amazing? And God tells them to get divorces. I don't get it. I don't get it. And of course, so many of us nowadays, particularly the youngsters, think that this is all a matter of feeling. All a matter of feeling. I got up this morning and I felt so-and-so. And they use some words that I don't use. And then they start telling you how they felt all day. I got up this morning and I felt good, you know. And this, that, and the other thing. And so many of us think we have to learn to love us before we can love anybody else. And that we have to build self-worth and self-confidence and all that stuff. I don't go along with that. It's my opinion that self-thinking is the thing that got us in the place we got. I think that self-thinking is insanity. I think that freedom is to get yourself off your mind. to get lost in life and find yourself in God. Now, there's another thing that goes with this, because if we do these steps honestly, applying them to ourselves, the first 9 steps will surrender anybody that'll take them. And then we can look deep within ourselves and find us, which includes our relationship to each other and to God. And along with this discovery comes a dignity, a value, a worth that is unspeakably wonderful. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the human ego. But it has everything to do with gratitude, gratitude, gratitude. I'm so grateful I can't see. I'm so grateful I can't see. If there's one thing I don't want, it's self-confidence. I was born with enough self-confidence for everybody west of the Mississippi River. And you know what it did for me? It kept me working on the problem 10 years after I'd lost. Self-confidence. I don't want any. I don't have time to think about self-worth or self-love. That is not in my living pattern, because it's not necessary. It is not necessary. The little dealy that I learned when I was a kid, that the 2 great needs of the individual are to be needed and to be loved, are just as backwards as everything else they taught me. The 2 great needs of the individual aren't to be needed and to be loved. The 2 great needs of the individual are to love and to do. To love and to do. If you love something or somebody, you do something for them. And that's what makes you feel good. That's what does it for you. And here, you do something for somebody else. So, this thing that we're in is so big that if we could see it, it'd blind us. It'd blind us. I want to tell you just a few of the little experiences that I've had that totally shatter me. For instance, it was my very good fortune to know Father Ed Dowling very well. Now, I don't happen to be Catholic, as I told you last night. But I got acquainted with Father Ed years and years and years ago. Father Ed was a Jesuit priest, and he was not an alcoholic. You read about him in AA Comes of Age. And he got interested in our little society back in the very early days, and he went back to Akron and spent a few days with him back there, and then over to New York and spent some time with him there. Understand, he was not an alcoholic. And he loved this thing, and he was a very great booster of ours until his death in 1960. Now, I knew him quite well, and we had a lot of time together. And one day we were talking, and Father Ed said to me, "Chuck," he says, "your cross was alcoholism." He says, "my cross was lack of faith." He says, "I went to school 18 years and was ordained a Jesuit priest, and I didn't believe nothing." Now, I can imagine that would be a very, very serious cross. Because here he is, a Jesuit priest. And he don't believe nothing. And then he said something to me that I couldn't repeat until the last 2 or 3 years without crying. He says, "I came to believe watching what happens to you people in Alcoholics Anonymous." Don't that curl your hair? I came to believe, watching what happens to you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's absolutely beautiful, in my opinion. I was talking maybe 20 years ago in St. Louis at the annual banquet, and Father Ed was there. And he gave a little prayer for those who had died in the program from the time it had started until that particular year. And I talked, and after the talk, we were going for coffee. And Mrs. C says, maybe Father Ed would like to go with us. And I said, maybe he would. You ask him. You see, I'm a sensitive alcoholic. I didn't want to ask him and get turned down. So I said, you ask him. And she did, and he went. And we slipped into the booth, and he immediately started plying me with questions, and he wouldn't quit. And every 15 minutes, I'd say, Father, you talk. I love to hear you talk. Talk! And he'd ask another question. And the last question he asked was, Chuck, he says, tell me about the family. And I said, no. Mrs. C is sitting here. She'll tell you about the family. And Mrs. C told him about the family. And he sat there, as was his habit, looking off into the eternity with his little old mouth pursed up like a rosebud, you know. And he finally turned to me and he said, you know something, Chuck? And I said, what, Father? He says, sometimes I have to believe that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. I think that's one of the most beautiful things I ever heard. Sometimes I have to believe that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. Now, that's exactly what this program is to me. I said to my wife, honey, where's the difference? This program to me is a new motivation, a new action pattern. And it's the difference between hell and heaven. A new pair of glasses. And another little thing that is so fabulous in my experience. A dozen years ago, Miss C and I went to Belfast. You might think it's Belfast, but it isn't. It's Belfast. Incidentally, the alcoholics over there don't take an inventory. They take an inventory. And they don't have any controversies. They have controversies. They have good controversies, but no controversies. And one of my hosts, a dozen years ago, some chap that we've seen many times, he had been a laborer in an asbestos factory. And a drunk, and a good drunk. And he was an orange man. And his avocation during his drinking years was running over Catholics. Now, this wasn't just walking over him. It was running over him with his car. Every time he caught one in the street that he could get through, he ran over him. And if he got a priest, it was triple stamps. So, this chap's name is Danny R. He's in the intergroup office in Belfast. Now he works there. But he got his lungs full of asbestos. And they had to retire him and pay him for not working. And he got sober. And he had a lot of time to work with alcoholics. Because he wasn't working. His wife had died. And it wasn't too long after Robbie got sober that he sponsored the Monsignor. Now, did you hear me? He not only just sponsored him, but the old boy was dying. And he carried him home with him. And personally spoon-fed him back to health. Now, this is Robbie. The guy that had been running over Catholics, you know. And this changed the whole setup in North Ireland. If you go to North Ireland today and you don't know a Catholic from a Protestant, they get along just like we do. Our little thing is the only thing in this 300 or 3,000 years or whatever they've been fighting over there that has ever bridged that chasm. The only thing. All the priests and popes and preachers for 300 years have never been able to do it. Now, this is not a judgment. This is just a fact. And our little thing bridges the whole deal. And the only time you would know that one or the other of the people was a Catholic and the other was a Protestant is when they send somebody on a 12-step call. And they never send one, they send two. And regardless who they're calling on, it's a Catholic and a Protestant. Now, I don't know about you, but this just curls my hair. This is absolutely fantastic to me. We were over there just a couple of years ago. The convention in Portrush, right on the north edge of Ireland. And there were something like 3,000 people there. And the only way that you were knowing them, there were quite a number of priests in the audience. And they had their robes on, but otherwise you would never know. Because they get along just like we do. The great, great thing about this thing of ours, we're colorblind, race blind, creed blind, and religion blind. But our program is totally spiritual. Totally spiritual. Now, many, many people think that alcohol causes alcoholism. I don't. I often say at the end of a talk, if there be fault, it is mine. If there be fault, it is mine. Because, you see, I don't believe there's fault. I think that people like you and I came into this world with everything necessary to be alcoholics except a bottle of grog. That's the only thing we had to add, and we were alcoholics from the gong. And I think it's because of the combination of characteristics with which we arrived. Now, having lived with people like you for 32 years, I am convinced from the top of my longest hair to my toenails that all of us are God's children, every one of us. If one of us is, all of us are. If one of us ain't, none of us are. And I am, so you is. So I believe we're all God's kids. And as such, all of us get these characteristics to a degree. But we're the only people that get them in the combination that we get them. For instance, I have never known an alcoholic, regardless of race, creed, or color, education or the lack of it, which side of the tracks we were born on, the contrary notwithstanding. I have never known an alcoholic that wasn't a perfectionist. Every one of us are perfectionists, idealists. Now that is a beautiful characteristic after we learn to live with it. But until we do, it'll kill us. Because it makes us demand more of ourselves than we can put out. And we are forever disappointed in our own performance. And it makes us demand more of those around us than they can put out. And so it makes it necessary for us to make them over. Now, you Al-Anons never noticed that, I'm sure. I told you last night, I spent 30 years trying to make the world over so it'd be a fit place for me to live in. And it ain't ready. But we have to make people over. Because they don't perform up to our standards. And it makes it impossible for us to integrate ourselves into the society around us. Because we don't like it. We don't like it. And so we're rebels from the beginning. I was a rebel from the very first memory I have. Not because I wanted to be, because I wanted and you wanted. More than anything in the world, to be a part of. And we're always a part from. From the earliest memory I have, I could never integrate. The next characteristic that came with us, we have known from the inside of us that life should be a good and a big and a beautiful thing. I knew when I was that high that life should be like it is now. But I looked at it and it was cheap and it was dirty and it was ugly. And I didn't like it. Still, to this day, after 32 years without a drink, there is a scene in The Days of Wine and Roses that just takes my heart out. I look at that thing and here the gal came to try to talk her husband and to rejoining her in the gin mills, you know. And she's standing looking out the window high above New York, begging him to rejoin her in the gin mills. And he's trying to beg her to join him in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's standing there looking out the window. She says, I can't. She says, when I look out this window, sober, it's cheap and it's dirty and it's ugly. And when I look out drunk, it's beautiful. That just rips the heart out of me. Because for 25 years of my life, the only way I could stand what I looked at was to be half in the bag. It hurt too much. It's a tough position to be in. And lastly, and I want you to be very kind to me, don't tell anybody that I said what I'm about to say. Particularly, don't tell your psychiatrist. We are a highly sensitive people. Did you ever hear anything worse than that? We are a highly sensitive people. There I lay in the gutter, and the pig got up and slowly walked away. This is the reason the psychiatrists of the world say that we're emotionally immature. Because we have several times the capacity for feeling that they have, and they can't understand us. For instance, I've got the, as I told you last night, I've got the finest view in the world. I look out my window clear to China on a clear day. Now, if a psychiatrist came in and found me lying there on the floor in front of that window, so drunk I couldn't lift my head up, crying my eyes out over a beautiful sunset, he'd say, emotional immaturity. He just don't know it's so damn pretty I can't stand it. You know? Now again, I haven't had a drink for a long time. But I can go down to my country in October. Beautiful. I can't stand it, you know? We are a highly sensitive people. I was building walls to keep from getting hurt long before I ever took a drink. Many years before I ever took a drink, I was building walls. Because people hurt me, things hurt me, conditions hurt me. And I didn't want to be hurt, so I'd build walls. Long before I ever took a drink. You know? I've talked to an audience bigger than this in Folsom Prison. And you can't even get into Folsom Prison for murder if it's the first time. You gotta be an habitual to get into Folsom. Those are the toughies. And I've stood there talking with them and watched the tears run out of their eyes and bounce off their bellies. And they never made one move to try to this thing's talking back to me now, for some reason. To conceal it, you know. Not a move. And it wasn't because they were emotionally immature. It was because they felt right here just exactly like I did. It was identity. Now all of these characteristics are beautiful when we learn to live with them. But until we do, they're killers. I'm convinced that there are only a few things that can happen to people like us. When we get here, either we're going to be priests or preachers or nuns or hopheads or drunks from the day we're born, because we cannot integrate ourselves in society around us. Now, when I took my first drink, it was not a problem. It was an answer. It was an answer. Proving that the problem was already here. Do you hear me? If the problem hadn't already been here, alcohol would not have been an answer. Alcohol's no answer to my wife, you know? But it was an answer to me. And I used it for 15 years as an answer. But being the wrong answer, it turned on me. And in the next 10 years, it made it absolutely necessary that I find the right answer, lest I die. Now, in my bad years, in my very bad years, I had to try to delude myself that I didn't even love my wife and my kids, because I didn't want to put them in a position that they could hurt me anymore. I'd been hurt too much, you know. I couldn't love anybody because I couldn't be hurt anymore. And that's one hell of a condition for a guy to have to live with. And the only medicine I had was booze. When I drink, it would allow me a little time in my own world, and it would take the rough edges off of yours. So alcoholism is a living problem. It's a living problem, and you and I must have a living answer. For instance, why am I not drunk this morning? Sunday. It's Mother's Day. I got to celebrate. It's Mother's Day. Why am I not drunk? There's no better time to be drunk than Sunday when it's Sunday. If it's Monday, that's the best day. So why am I not drunk this morning? There's only one reason. There are not two, there's just one. The reason I am not drunk is because I have the thing I was looking for in the bottle. I've got it. What is the thing? I'm not fighting me or you or life or God or the devil. I am at peace with me and you and with my very own God. And that is the only reason I'm not drunk. When I got to the program, we heard all the time, if you haven't had a drink today, you're sober. This is 32 years ago. If you haven't had a drink today, you're sober. But now, we don't think that at all. We know that sobriety is built on not drinking today. But that's merely the foundation. I cannot drink and live. And I myself, I can't keep from drinking. So it's most necessary that I don't drink today if I'm going to live, if I'm going to survive. But that's just the foundation, not drinking today. Sobriety is fourfold. It's physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual, and it adds up to the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with me. With me! Now, when I can live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with me, I haven't the slightest trouble living with you. It's a cinch. It's easy. This is the pearl of great price, that we can live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with ourselves. And that's the only reason I'm not drunk. You know, we have two or three little things in our program that we forget. We forget. When we first get here, it's a cinch to live one day at a time. Because we can't think any longer than that. We can't get into next week. We can't get out of last year. That's the trouble with it. So it's very simple for us to live one day at a time. And we start getting freed up right off the bat. But you just let us stick around the program for a little while and find that the newness is wearing off of the program and find that the people aren't that hot. We discover that one or two people in Alcoholics Anonymous might have clay feet. And it kills us, you know. And we start looking off down the road a piece. And we get very unhappy, for instance. A number of years ago, you people aren't going any place this morning, are you? We're due for all day. I don't leave till 7 o'clock or something. A number of years ago, I met a nurse in Glendale, in our program. And after the meeting was over, I said, Sue, let's get a hot fudge sundae or something and a cup of coffee in Yakima. She says, I can't. She says, I've got a little child at home, and I've got a babysitter, and I can't afford to spend any more money than just to come to the meeting and go home. And so I can't go with you. And I said, well, let's get some ice cream and some nuts or something and take it home with us. And she said, all right, we did. And we went home, dismissed this babysitter. And we had her ice cream and nuts. And you know something? She only had one spoon in the house. She had one spoon in that house to feed the baby with. And we sat there eating ice cream. With one spoon. She was a nurse, so I wasn't afraid of it. Now, the little boy was maybe at that time a year old. And about 7 years later, she called me. She at this time was working in Long Beach in the hospital down there. And she was fit to be tied. Oh, she was down the drain. And she had to see me. And so I was still in the business world at that time, so I made a date with her. It's Saturday at 10 o'clock to come to my house. And she did, and she came down there. And oh, she was in bad shape. And this was her problem. Here she was, a lone woman, with nobody to help her. And she was going to have to put this child through college. You know, by herself. And she was crying and having an awful time. And I let her cry until she was about cried out. And I said, "Sue, don't you think we ought to wait for 2 or 3 weeks before we matriculate him in college? He's only 8 years old." And she started laughing. And she's never quit. The kid's 17 now, and he's bigger than I am. You know, he's good and doing all right. He'll make his way through college himself. But isn't that funny? She's going to have to put him through college. And I was killing her. So, the one day at a time is our thing. Now, another thing that we forget. When we get here, they tell us that you can't be grateful and unhappy at the same time. You can't be grateful and unhappy at the same time. And we buy it. And we live by it. For a little while. And then things get sort of complacent with us. And we forget that. And we start forgetting to be grateful that we're alive. Sobriety has become a habit. Or not drinking has become a habit. And we forget to be grateful. Now, it's prima facie evidence. If I'm unhappy, I'm not grateful. And I have a simple little thing. If I get up in the morning and I want to throw all of you people right out on your ears, you know, and you do that sometimes, all I've got to do is take one quick look over my shoulder. And take just a glance at me the last week before I came to this program. And I start whistling Dixie. You know? It's so simple. I get lots of kids down at my place. They come up and see me. We talk a while. And they say to me, finally. They say, in the first place, talking about surrender, they tell me that you can't surrender. The kids tell me, if you surrender, you're the hole in the donut. You're nothing. Without the ego drive and the personal ambition, you're nothing. And then they quote me William James, you know, as if I didn't know Bill. And they quote me the little thing about hitching your wagon to a star and beating your brains out, and finally you'll get there, you know. You got to have ego drive and personal ambition. And I say, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe the thing that takes its place is so infinitely greater than ego drive and personal ambition that it would be like comparing one drop of water to the whole Pacific Ocean. And what is the thing that takes its place? It's a glimpse of the infinite possibility that is inherent in the first two words of the Lord's Prayer. Our Father God. As we said last night, if this be true, and everything in me knows it's true, you can let your imagination go crazy and not even get close to the truth of being itself. The carpenter man put it like this. Whatsoever the Son, you, me, seeth the Father do, that doeth the Son also, that the Father may be glorified through the Son. Which means to me, whatever I can conceive of God doing through me, I can do. To infinity. If it's not for my glory, but for the glory of life itself. The glory of God. To infinity. Now, what is then going to keep me from being disappointed with my performance today? Because there's so many things that you'd like to do, like telling somebody to get the hell up and walk, you know. And maybe you can't make it today. What's the difference? Think of what you can do today that you couldn't do. For instance, one of the great experiences of the alcoholic is to be able to see the light come back into the eyes of a living dead man or dead woman. See him reborn in front of your eyes. This is a fantastic experience. But I couldn't do that 32 years ago. You know, I couldn't even get up to talk to him, let alone have a message. You see? So in the fullness of time, these things will become just as natural to us as talking with an alcoholic and watching him reborn. You know? It's a fantastic thing. When we actually take step number 3, turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, we are no longer our problem. We are His problem. We turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Self-concern has no place in our lives from then on. Self-concern is nothing in the world but saying, look, Dad, I don't believe you're quite as familiar with this problem as I am. I got to get you some outside help. And you go to the doctor and he thinks your problem is a Valium deficiency. There's no use to turn your will and your life over to a God you can't trust. You might as well keep it. I can't trust me. I might as well have kept it. We enter a new dimension of life. An infinite father, an infinite child, and an infinite journey. And it's absolutely fascinating. No destination. There'll always be as much ahead of us as there is right now. 10,000 times 10,000 years from now. There'll be as much ahead of us as there is this morning. Because we're looking at infinity. Now here's a little thing that I love to think about myself. And maybe you'll like it, maybe you won't. I suspect that in 32 years, I've been through the first 2.5 pages of chapter 5, probably 35,000 times, no less. Now, to the learned, they would say that would be the driest reading on the face of the earth. It's not last month's dishwater, it's 10 years ago's dishwater. There are only 450 words or thereabouts in the first 2.5 pages, chapter 5. And they would think that that would be the driest reading on the face of the earth, but it isn't. Every time I read it, it's new. It's brand new. Because there's no such thing as the meaning of a word. There is no such thing as the meaning of words. Now, those words are the same as they were the first time I ever read them. But I am not. So, the words change as I change. The meaning of the words change. And the significance is brand new every time I read it. Every time I pray the Lord's Prayer, it's brand new to me. Now, of course, I'm a maverick again, because I change things to suit myself. There's a line in the Lord's Prayer that I don't like. I didn't like it the first time I ever heard it. It says, "Lead us not into temptation." Well, my God never could lead me into temptation, and I knew it when I was a kid. I knew He couldn't lead me into temptation, and I didn't like that line. So, I tried to change it to fit. And along as time went on, I got over into St. James, and I found on the first page, it says, if you're tempted, don't say I'm tempted by God. God cannot be tempted by evil, neither can He tempt any man. If you are tempted, it's because of your own desires. Now, I can go right down the road with that. But I can't go down the road 1 foot with a God that would tempt me to see whether I loved Him or not. I'd be afraid to even pull that on you. And then a little later on, I got me a New Testament. This is a direct translation from Aramaic to English. And this is the way that it's said there. Thou leadest us not into temptation, but delivereth us from evil. Now that makes sense. So I like that. So I say it the same as you do, but I think it the other way. I change it all. I change my Levitt step. There's too many words in it. I get up in the morning and I say, look, Dad, I'm reporting for duty. Now, I'm going to move it around. I'm going to do the best I can with what I got. And all I want out of you is a little guidance and direction, power to carry it out. Sure, thank you. And I go about my business. I don't wait for Him to tell me what to do. I go do it. Reminds me of the priest talking to the rabbi. And he said to the rabbi, he says, what would you be doing next Tuesday at 2 o'clock if you knew that the second coming of Christ was going to happen right there? And the rabbi says, I'd act busy. So I act busy. And I get my guidance and direction. You see. And then there's another one that I had to change, and this tickles me, and I'll quit this for long. I don't want to, but I will. St. Francis' prayer. I love that prayer of St. Francis. You know, he says, for it's better to love than to be loved. It's better to understand than to be understood. For it is in giving that we receive, in forgiving that we're forgiven, and in dying that we awaken to eternal life. Now, I didn't like that dying, because I didn't want to wait that long. But I'm going to stick around here a long time. I like it here. So, in playing with it, I decided that the guy meant dying to self, which is surrender. And I just changed it. Dying to self. Now that makes sense to me, because that's what happened to me in January 1946. The bottle did it. I didn't. The bottle did it for me. So, I said to myself, well, I talked to a lot of people, and a lot of them are Catholics. And maybe I shouldn't say that without checking it out. So I called the Manresa Retreat House. It's a Jesuit retreat house in Azusa, California. I happen to know all the padres out there. So I called up and I got old Father Toner on the line. And I says, "Father, listen to what I did to the prayer of St. Francis. For it is in dying to self that we awaken to eternal life." And he says, "What the hell do you think he meant?" Just like he had known it all his life, you know. He never thought of it until I told him. Now I'm going to share a few little things that are so sweet to me. And so personal. They're so personal. Not long after I came to the program, a kid came up to me after a meeting, and I talked. And it was sort of laborious in those days. It's not sure anymore, as you've noticed. But I was sort of tired. And this kid came up to me and he says, "Chuck," he says, "do you know why it's so hard for us to find God?" And I didn't want to answer him because I thought, well, I'm going to have to stand here and listen for an hour while somebody explains why it's so hard for us to find God. And I don't want to. I want to get out of here. But he had me cornered. And I had to say to him, "No, why is it so hard for us to find God?" And the kid says, "Because he ain't lost." I then went ahead to say, "You see, all we got to do is come back home. And we find that God's always been there. We have been away. But God's always been there." And then there's an old boy showed up down there from Michigan, Flint, Michigan. And his name was Big Smith. And Big Smith was my type of drunk. He was just a man after my own heart. Because he drove his car off of the end of piers, through brick buildings. And he had one leg about that longer than the other. And he walked like he was sneaking up on somebody. And Smitty came walking into a meeting down in Hawthorne, and he had a plaque under his arm. And this is what the plaque said: "If you're not as close to God as you once were, or as you would like to be, make no mistake, you're the one that moved." Isn't that beautiful? It's fantastic. It's fantastic. Then on a Sunday night like this, I talked in Highland Park. And after the meeting, there were about four of us in the middle of the room with our arms on each other's shoulders. And we were saying to each other, "How fortunate can a man be? How fortunate can a man be that he be returned from the land of the living dead to a life like this?" And one kid wasn't saying anything. He was just sitting there, or standing there. And finally he looks to me and he says, "Chuck," he says, "I'm ignorant." He says, "I ain't never read no books." He says, "There's no sense in me reading books because I don't understand them." He says, "I don't know nothing about God, and I don't know nothing about the Bible. But this no man can take away from me. When I do these simple things one day at a time to the best of my ability, I feel clean inside, and good things happen in my life." And when I could talk, which wasn't too sudden, I said, "Eddie, don't ever read no books, no time. This is the essence of every book that we'll ever read, that we might feel clean inside and have good things happen in our lives." It's fantastic. This is AA. And then, another little thing that is so precious to me. I don't know where it came from. I read a version of it that's pre-Zen the other day in a very ancient writing. And I don't know where I got it, but it's the story of the three little fish. These three little fish were swimming around in the water off the shores of Laguna Beach on a Sunday morning. And they'd already had breakfast, and they weren't even hungry. They were just playing around out there in the water. And a big wise fish swam by. And he said to them, "Good morning, boys. Isn't the water fine this morning?" And then he swam on off. And as soon as he was out of hearing, the little fish got together. And he says, "The man spoke about water." He says, "What's water?" He says, "You, did you ever hear about water?" "Never heard of it." "How about you?" "Never heard of it." Neither did I. So they swam all over the Pacific Ocean, hunting for water. In which they lived and moved and had their being. Now this is what I did for 30 years. I went all over the religions and philosophies of the world trying to find God, and I couldn't find him. I came here not looking for him. Got lost with people like you, his kids, and discovered that someplace along the line we'd found each other. It's absolutely beautiful. Now, this will be my last little dealy. After I'd moved to Laguna, but before I'd retired, so it had to be on a weekend, I was sitting there in my big chair, looking out the window, and out from the corner over here in the ocean came a bunch of snowbirds. Now for you landlubbers, that's a certain size sailboat. Snowbirds, they call them snowbirds. And here they were, and they were in a race. And I just sat in there idly looking at them. And it occurred to me that every one of them was going a little bit different direction. And there was only one wind. Do you hear me? Only one wind. And as I looked at them, a little verse popped in my head that I'd known forever. But it never meant too much to me. I don't even know where I found it. But it said, the verse said this: "Some ships ply east and some ply west by the self-same wind that blows. 'Tis the set of the sail and not the gale that determines where it goes." And from then until now, I've had a little habit of trimming the sails. You know, the carpenter man told us to pray without ceasing. Many another have told us. Brother Lawrence said, "Pray without ceasing. Don't ever quit praying." And in my own thinking, any serious thought is a prayer. So it behooves us to watch our thinking. Pray without ceasing. So all day long I keep saying to myself, for instance, "God is my refuge and my strength. Fear not, little flock, it's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. Take no thought of the morrow, what you shall eat, what you shall drink, or wherewithal you shall be clothed. The Heavenly Father knoweth what you have need of before you ask it. Lift up thine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh thy strength." Now I'll say these things to myself maybe hundreds of times in a day. Why? Just to trim the sails. Just to trim the sails. To maintain myself in the conscious awareness of the living presence of God. In Him I live and move and have my being. And to be consciously aware of this is the difference between hell and heaven. It's a fantastic thing. And every bit of it has come out of my association with people like you. 32 years that I've been able to walk down the corridors of life with people like you. People who shared with me when those of my own flesh and blood wouldn't spit on me. And my gratitude is so great that I can't even get close to it. And it starts with you. Because that's the way it started with me. It came first from you. Sharing your experience, strength, and hope with me. When I had no hope. And then it goes to the program. And then it goes to God. Because you see, that's the way it happened to me. You and the program. And God. And so that's the way my gratitude is. And I don't think God cares, you know. Because I think He knows that He is the program. And that He is you. And that He is me. God bless you. Thank you very much.